Hey y'all, welcome to another episode of Jesse's Fireside Chats. Today I'm going to be talking to you about a few theories that I have come up with recently. So, let's get started. First one I'd like to get to is relating to my previous claim that the political spectrum is not a horseshoe, that it is rather a wheel or a cartoon sun in shape, because the different spokes represent the different worldviews, different, like, bases that worldviews are built around that lead people to where they fit on the spectrum, while the circle represents the anarchist to authoritarian spectrum. Because when you think of left and right, you forget that at the extreme ends of both is anarchy and totalitarianism. And so my theory relating to that is that I further fleshed that out, and I think that you know, when you get to the ends of the circle, the edges, like the top and bottom parts, you approach something I call ideological fade. An ideological fade, as I would define it, is that as you get closer to the extremes, whether it's the extreme authoritarianism, so fascism and communism, which I've already said are basically one and the same, and I still believe that, or the anarchist side of things, where it's anarcho-capitalism or anarcho-communism or just anarchism. As you get closer to one or the other of the extremes, the ideologies, whether they started out as left or right, start to fade. Like, it starts to become harder to tell the left-leaning person from the right-leaning person, because they've become so extreme that the ideology has started to erode. It has started to distort and has become just, you know, it's become just pure radicalism. And so that's why I think, especially when it comes to the totalitarian side of things, because whether you claim to be a far-right fascist or a far-left communist, you're essentially arguing for the same thing, just using different language. Because at the end of the day, a communist country or a fascist country is going to look basically the same. There's going to be propaganda, it's going to be authoritarianism, you're going to have an absolute dictator who kills or gulags anyone he disagrees with. You're going to have some level of corruption, because there's no world in which the government can successfully run every industry. Like, even if you look at communist China, they have certain businesses that are allowed to thrive and certain ones that are not, because of backroom deals. And North Korea has had to allow markets to an extent, because otherwise you end up with famines because of government mismanagement, combined with crop failures and stuff. And then when you get to anarchism, the opposite extreme, no matter if the person claims to be a left-wing anarchist or a right-wing anarchist, they're both advocating chaos, because anarchy, no matter which side it claims to be on, is going to essentially have the same result, which is chaos, a power vacuum, everybody doing what they want, every man for himself, and that power vacuum is going to be filled, and most likely it will be filled by the strongest or the richest or the most powerful person, because nature abhors a vacuum. So that's essentially what happens, is that as you get further on the circle, as you get closer to one of the extremes or the other, The ideology stops being distinct from the other side's ideology that you claim to hate. So if you claim, you know, if you're going further and further and further and further to the left, and you're approaching that communist extreme, and you claim to hate fascists, you know, if you sit with these leftists, which I used to, because I used to be one, if you sit with them, they're going on all day about how they hate fascists, and they gotta fight the fascists, and fascist this, and fascist that, and fascists made my car not start, and fascists made my bad cup of coffee, and blah, 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 blah. But the thing is that as you become further and further to the left, you get closer and closer to being a communist, you start to actually become more like the ideology you claim to hate. So the ideology starts to fade and warp and distort. So that's why I call it ideological fade. I guess ideological distortion could also be another name for it. And I've even gotten to thinking about this a bit further. And I think that the way people form their political views is kind of like the way people write a budget. So when you do a budget, as anybody should know who's listening to this, who's an adult or even a teenager, when you do a budget, you're deciding, what can I afford, first of all? What can I have with the limited resources that I have? Because even, I mean, Elon Musk probably doesn't have a very precise budget because he has a ton of money, but most of us have nowhere near what he has. And so we know that our money is not infinite. I mean, even his is not. But, like, since your money's not infinite, you have to prioritize. Okay, what can I afford? What do I have to spend it on? And then with what's left over, what can I afford to spend it on that's discretionary spending? And I think it's the same way when people form their political views, because we only have so much passion and we only have so much mental bandwidth. Which is part of why a lot of people here in America don't really have a lot of bandwidth to spare for conflicts that have nothing to do with us. It's not because we hate Ukrainians or we hate the people of Afghanistan. It's just we don't live there and we have more pressing things to worry about because we live in America and America has enough problems of its own. Like the fact that we are in a constant death spiral with debt, for one thing. Eventually, you know, we can only kick that can down the road for so long, and eventually there could come a time where the U.S. defaults on the debt because we simply cannot pay it. And when that day comes, it's going to be a bad day for a lot of people. That's just one example of a thing that we have here at home. And anyway, getting back to this budgeting thing. So, when you write a budget, there's usually two main types of budgets. I learned this in one of my public admin classes. There is a zero-based budget, which is where you start from zero, and you basically do it from scratch. And then there is a line item budget. A line item budget is usually from year to year you have different line items that remain, or if you have to add new ones or take ones away, then you do that. But basically, you go through and you figure out, okay, I'm going to spend this much on electric, I'm going to spend this much on water, I'm going to spend this much on gas, whatever it may be. And I think when people form their political views, it's very different to the, very similar, but also different to how we write a budget. Because you could say that some people are single-issue voters. They start from one issue and they form everything else around that. So that one issue is kind of like their zero. So they use kind of a zero-based system, if you want to call it that. That might not be a perfect analogy, but it kind of works. And then it's a better analogy for those of us that are not single-issue, that have a basis that all of our worldview fits around, and we can build everything around that. And that's kind of like having line items. So if you are like me, and a lot of your views come from the Bible or biblical principles, and also from the and then also from the Constitution further down, you know, you can kind of build everything around that. You can decide, okay, based on what I know about the Bible and what I know about the Constitution, and obviously the Bible comes first, what do I have, what can I and what should I use my mental bandwidth and my passion for? And when I run out of that bandwidth, well, then that means I don't have any more, pardon my language, that means I don't have any more craps to give. That means I can't spend more passion and more bandwidth for other issues that have nothing to do with us, for example, because all of my mental bandwidth, all of my passion is, has already been allotted. There's already other issues that I care about that use that mental bandwidth. And so I can also say that some issues will get more than others. Like, for example, for me, the issue of life, the issue of accessibility rights, the issue of, keeping people from getting confused or from, praying for those who have become confused and believing we shouldn't affirm confusion. Those are some issues that get a lot of mental bandwidth for me. Economics is kind of somewhere in the middle because I'm not an expert on economics. I have some basic opinions about it, but it's not my main thing. And then a lot of foreign policy gets less because that's not, I don't care. It's not that I don't care about the people, it's just that I don't live there. I don't live there and we have enough problems here. And so that's just the way that I operate, and that's just an example. I'm sure for some people that map might work differently. That political budget might work differently. I know there are some people where foreign policy gets a lot of that bandwidth. The climate myth, if they believe in it, which I don't, as you know, so therefore it doesn't get much because I don't believe in it, so I don't care. But for those who do, you know, that might be an important issue for them. Therefore, they might decide that a lot of their passion, a lot of that mental bandwidth is going to go towards that climate myth and believing that it's not a myth and that we should fight it and all that crap. And so that's essentially what I think when it comes to the political spectrum, that it's a wheel or a cartoon sun in shape instead of a line or a horseshoe. And that as you get closer to the ends of the two extremes, like as you get closer towards absolute authoritarianism, fascism or communism, or as you get close to the other end of anarchism, the ideologies stop being super distinct from each other. As they get closer together, they become less distinct and they start to warp and fade and distort. Even if the other side claims to hate, even if side A claims to hate side B, they start to become more and more similar. All the socialists and communists that claim to hate fascists, but their ideology is essentially fascism. And so that's essentially the only thing left distinguishing the two sides once they have become super close together. So you could call it ideological fade or you could call it ideological distortion. But either way, it is, it's a thing. And then the fact, proposal that I've made that the way people form their political views is like the way people write budgets. They either have a single issue system, which is kind of like a zero-based budget. And so, you know, they have this one issue they care about. Everything kind of forms around that. Or They're like me. They have a worldview that is based on certain things. Like, for me, it'd be the Bible first and then the Constitution. So, based on those things, they essentially create a line item budget that decides how much mental bandwidth will be allocated towards different issues. So you could say that the way people form their political views is kind of like the way that people write budgets, because like when you're writing a budget and you have to decide how to use your finite financial resources, you're also, when you form your political worldview, you have to decide how to allocate your finite passion and mental bandwidth, because everybody only has so much. Like it's been documented, there's a phenomenon, for example, called compassion fatigue, where you're asked to care about so much and you just get tired of it. And it's become especially a common thing in the age of social media, where you're seeing all this stuff that's happening all over the world every day, and it's just like you're just drained after a while, because it's like you want to care about him, you want to care about that, you want to care about this, but you just can't, because you've cared so much. So now I want to move on to my next thing, and that is that while I don't necessarily think it's a good thing for Ukraine to be absorbed by Russia, I don't think it was good that Russia invaded Ukraine, I will say, and I have said, that the U.S. should stay out of it, because we're not Ukrainian, it's not our thing, it's not our war. We have enough problems here at home. And also, I got to thinking that if, heaven forbid, Russia did fully consume Ukraine, it would be bad for Ukraine, and it wouldn't be great. But it could also have one good consequence. And that would be, so the U.S. does not like trading with Russia, since Russia decided to go around invading people. Understandably, the U.S. doesn't want to trade with somebody that's going to invade their neighbors and conquer them. Like, that's not cool. And so, if the U.S. does not want to trade with Russia, and Ukraine becomes fully part of Russia, I don't know how much the U.S., right now, it depends on Ukrainian wheat, but I do know that Ukrainian wheat goes all over the world. Especially to, like, Africa, Asia, Europe. So, if the U.S., if Ukraine was fully absorbed by Russia, then the one good thing that could happen from that is that U.S. farmers could, see that there's an increased demand in wheat, and that could incentivize them to grow more wheat, which could not only stop the nonsense of putting solar panels on farmland, but also, that all of that wheat, that could become a great export for the U.S. Kind of like what happened in World War One, I guess it was before World War One, but also in World War One. So in 1905, Russia had a political revolution that failed. It was a failed communist revolution. So then the demand for wheat became a lot more, because, Russians, weren't growing as much wheat because of this. And so, not only, I'm sure Russia probably wanted some of that, but also the Europeans. And then World War One hit, and, all of Europe was involved in this war, so they couldn't exactly grow crops very well. So then the U.S. ended up sending a lot more wheat over there. So, you could have the same thing happen again if Ukraine absorbs Russia. But again, that is the only good thing that could come out of that. And I'm not saying that Ukraine should get absorbed by Russia. I'm just pointing out that unintended consequences or further downstream consequences have been a thing throughout history, and are still able to be a thing today. And that I don't think we should have solar panels on farmland. I think that, you know, the people in the cities, the liberals in the cities, are the ones who want the solar panels the most, so put the solar panels on the roofs of their buildings instead of on farmland. Because farmland is for farming. It's not that complicated. And, you know, especially if they're not going to fix their parking problem in the cities by building rooftop parking, which I think would be a great idea, but a lot of people disagree with me on that. So that's basically what I think, is that, you know, we should stop putting solar panels on farmland. Perhaps one way that could happen, even if it is from a bad event where Russia, which we hope Russia does not absorb Ukraine, but if that happened, perhaps the only good consequence for that could be that the U.S. could need to export more wheat, and that could lead to an end to the nonsense of putting solar panels on farmland, at least in the U.S. Maybe in other countries too, because other countries could also see the increased demand. Because the U.S. is not the only country where people think farmland is for solar panels, apparently. I have no problem if a family wants solar, but it's not reliable enough yet, and even if it was, farmland is not the place for that. If you want solar, put it on the roof of your building, okay? It's not that complicated. You claim solar takes up a lot of space. Yeah, those roofs could be space too. And, you know, you're the one using it, so that might make it more efficient for it to get to your building, if it's on the roof of your building, rather than transporting it from a farm to your building. And so I think, yes, I think that there can be unintended consequences, and there have been throughout history. And I know I've gone on about this, but I just, I'm still kind of fleshing this theory out. It's not as fleshed out as my political fade theory. And then the last theory I want to get into is, so Trump started talking about Canada being the 51st state a few months ago. And at first, I thought he was just joking. But considering how frequently he has doubled down on it and how detailed he has gotten in making the case for Canada to be a 51st state, I'm not sure if he's joking now. I know some people get mad at him every time he tells a joke, but I don't. I give him quite a bit of grace. But in this case, I'm like, I don't know if this is a joke. I genuinely don't know. And I think I actually can see, I think I can actually see a thing going on. You know, some people are like, why is he happy about Mark Carney winning the election in Canada? Well, I think I can imagine why. If Mark Carney continues to do what the Liberal Party has done and make Canada weak and dysfunctional, which he probably will, then that instability could open the door to making Canada the 51st state. And I just, you know, I don't think that that's good. I wish that the conservative person had won in Canada. Now, I know, you know, it's Canada, it's not the U.S., so I don't spend a ton of time or bandwidth on it, but I just, that's what I think. And for them, you know, they're closer. Ukraine is all the way across the freaking ocean versus Canada's right there. Like, even of the countries that border us, Canada's closer because, you know, I live in Indiana, so, Canada is, you know, there's Indiana, there's Michigan, and then there's Canada. So, I mean, it's not even like Mexico where it's further away because it's all the way down, all the way down there. You know, Texas is pretty far away. And so those are just kind of my thoughts that I think I can see. I don't know if this is the case, but I think I can see a potential reason why Trump would be happy, or even if not Trump himself, some of the people that are in his corner would be happy about the election in Canada. While Trump has made the case for Canada to be a 51st state repeatedly and in a very detailed way. Because if the Liberal Party causes economic and political instability, that could open the door for Canada to be made into the 51st state. So those are just kind of my thoughts on that. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode or consider it to be food for thought. You can find this podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, the RSS feed, iHeartRadio, and Pandora, and Apple Podcasts, and Audible. You can also contact us on our Facebook page at Jesse's Fireside Chats and on X JFSC Pod. You can send us an email at jessesfiresidechats@gmail.com. That's JESSEAS firesidechats@gmail.com. You can also feel free to pass this along to anybody you know that might be interested, and please come back next time. Thank you so much for listening, and have a blessed day.